Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month. No commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast. I think it's generally considered to be the greatest books pod in the UK.
Oh, just in the UK?
Well,
oh, right. Well,
it, yeah, well I, from what I hear around the colonies, it's generally well thought of around the world.
Well, as well. Okay.
All over the Commonwealth.
Right, right. All
in
of
fact,
those places.
We should consider going on a Books Commonwealth tour.
Now, where this we, I can get behind, yeah.
Where, so we could go, you know, Caribbean, Australia, New Zealand.
Yeah. All those
Canada.
Places. Lovely. Definitely going there, yes.
This could be good, couldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, you can invite us and we'll come and do a show at your bookshop. An email from Emma Henry. Dear debut novel and difficult follow-up. Says Emma, in Exeter. Love the podcast. I've never read anything by Jonathan Freeland before, but after hearing him talk about The Traitor's Circle, he's now on my list.
Yes.
Your oft-mentioned Agatha Christie anecdote via Alex Michaelides might not be quite right.
Oh, no.
This is terrible. I recently visited her excellently kept home Greenway in Devon and have since learnt that Agatha was teetotal and drank a glass of double cream with dinner. Not exclusively. I prefer Alex's version, but I don't think it's 100% accurate. But
no, that's fine. That stands up.
I mean, that's not far off.
It was a dinner guest.
Yes.
So if you're inviting Agatha Christie for dinner, she is only drinking full fat cream.
I think it's the only bit that Emma is suggesting that she would definitely drink double cream with dinner, but maybe she would have
something else as well.
Yeah, a chaser.
A chaser.
Yeah, a bit of evaporated milk or something like that. I keep meaning to adopt a glass into my skincare regime as to look again at her photos. Her skin was amazing. So maybe she was onto something. Maybe, you know, it's not going to do your cholesterol any good.
No.
But your skin is going to look fabulous.
Yes.
Emma, thank you.
Simon and Matt says an email from Robert Cooper. I'm trying to create the ultimate playlist of songs inspired by or about books.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm running up a pretty chunky list so far, but I would love some suggestions from your good selves, being both bookworms and musos. I've no doubt you'll think outside the box. Love the pod, says Rob. So...
What's on there?
So, well, there's quite a few. So, Wuthering Heights, Kate Bush. I think you pick a track that you like, and hopefully you also like the book that it's inspired by. And I love Wuthering Heights, and I love that track. So it's the most obvious one on that list, but that would be the one for me.
Okay. So he's also put down 1984 by David Bowie.
Uh-huh.
Matilda, Harry Styles. Inspired by Roald Dahl, All Quiet on the Western Front, Elton John, Battle of Evermore, Led Zeppelin, Don Quixote, Nick Kershaw, Ghost of Tom Joad, Bruce Springsteen, that's a good one. Home at Last, Steely Dan, Little Lion Man, Mumford & Sons, Tolerate It, Taylor Swift, inspired by Rebecca De Mornay, and White Rabbit, Jefferson Airplane, inspired by Alice in Wonderland. Oh, that's interesting, because I was kind of thinking, oh, Paperback Writer by the Beatles and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So this is far more specific,
I
think. So, Rob, thank you. Well, let's continue that theme. And if there is something for Rob's playlist, which maybe you have a similar playlist, let us know about it, and then we can add to it in future episodes. Booksoftheyear@yahoo.com
yes.
is where you can email us if you want to add to the list or just get in touch. And we're on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Pick Any Page. Now we're going to speak to best-selling author Jennifer Niven. She has her first adult novel. It's going to be one of our Books of the Year and issues. Okay, we have a fantastic book for you this week. Meet the Newmans is the latest by Jennifer Niven, who is here in the studio. I thought you were going to be down the line in Los Angeles or somewhere cool, but it's very nice to see you.
It's very nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm amazing. I'm doing better because I'm here with you all.
Well, that's for
wow, that's going well so far.
And you're the first author to dress as the cover.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, Matt, so describe the cover and then people will know exactly.
Yeah. So basically, there are two different covers, so UK and US. I have to say, I prefer the UK one, which is it's a blue check background, which straight away shouts out domesticity. And right in the top right-hand corner, we see a woman with a pencil between her teeth, playing with her pearls, and she's looking down at the title Meet the Newmans, and that the Meet the Newmans is very much done in the style of like a 1950s 1960s sitcom from the US, and Jennifer Niven in big bold black letters at the bottom.
Is it gingham? Is that
gingham? I'm out of my comfort zone, so
but,
I don't know.
But also, you can say check.
Checked. Yeah. Yeah. So like gingham.
Gingham.
That's right. Okay. So Jennifer is wearing a blue and white jacket.
Yeah,
the same as the cover.
I am. Isn't it precious?
It's fantastic.
Lovely.
I think this is going to be a new thing. We're going to ask all authors to dress in some way, something related to their cover.
Yeah. I think they should.
Yeah.
You started a trend. So the book is called Meet the Newmans. So who are the Newmans, and why are we meeting them?
So the Newmans are America's favorite TV family in 1964. They've been on the air for about 12 years. It's Father Del, who's the creative motor behind the show, Mom Dinah, and their sons, Guy and Shep, who have basically grown up on television. And they have been beloved for a long time, but now times are changing. It's 1964. The world is changing around them, but they haven't changed. So they are sorely out of touch, out of date, and they're in danger of being canceled.
This is canceled as in the TV sense of the word,
not in the
2026 social media
sense. I heard that as I said it. I was like, let's make that clear. The show's in danger of being canceled. Yes, thank you. And it's very scary for them.
So why 1964?
I chose 1964 because I had read something in all of my research about the 60s, and someone had said America woke up on January 1st, 1964, very much still in the 50s. But on December 31st, 1964, they went to bed in the throes of the 60s. And I thought, that is what I want, because I want this year of tumult and change and upheaval, because this family hasn't changed for 12 some, you know, plus years, and they need to. And they need something to get them to.
Okay. So just to put us in the picture, because our TV heritage is slightly different to yours. Yeah. And I was five when this family are leading up to their season finale, as we get to in the book. So I don't remember the I Love Lucy scene clips of it. I never saw the Dick Van Dyke Show. So I was thinking of the TV shows that, because I was more of a child of the 70s, so I saw The Monkees, which kind of came out of this kind of family.
Yes.
And Bewitched was the only other show. Did you ever see Bewitched?
I don't know. No. Monkees I know, but the rest of them.
What about
no
the
idea.
Brady Bunch?
No.
So just tell us about this kind of TV family, which we kind of know about because we love Dick Van Dyke, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And we remember the Monkees, but we didn't have those other shows.
It's a black and white family comedy. And in this particular one, the Newmans play themselves. So there was a show called Ozzie and Harriet, in which Ozzie and Harriet Nelson were the parents, David Nelson and Ricky Nelson, who became a huge teen idol. They were the kids, and they played themselves on television. And that always fascinated me, because they played these very, you know, mom was in the kitchen, mom was vacuuming, mom wore the pearls and the heels while she did, and dad went off to some job that was never named, and the boys were wholesome, and, you know, their troubles were never very big. And everything was solved and wrapped up nicely in 30 minutes. And, you know, nothing was ever very challenging or upsetting or didn't really represent the outside world as it was. So I was always fascinated by that because shows like that, like Ozzy and Harriet, The Brady Bunch, shows that I grew up on, there was something called Nick at Night. We had a...
Is that Nickelodeon?
That's right. Yeah. And they had... They aired all of these shows. I Love Lucy, The Dick Van Dyke Show, Bewitched. And I kind of grew up watching these reruns and just fascinated by these very, like, wholesome, unrealistic families and people. But I love the behind the scenes even more because that's where the, you know, kind of interesting stuff was.
So I love this book, Jennifer. I to give you a sort of insight into the books that we get here is I have this sort of rule where I always read the book the first time on the tube on the way into work because I know that I'm not going to get interrupted and I'm going to get a good 20-25 minutes of reading. And I always feel that that's what I need for the book to be able to bed in. And I remember like that first journey coming out of it and telling Simon, you've got to read this book, so, so good. The start is absolutely machine tool to keep you reading, Jennifer. So
amazing.
Absolutely well done with that. I want to pick up on something that you've already talked about because within the first couple of chapters, I think, we get a sort of excerpt of a review of Meet the Newmans, in which effectively the premise is spelled out to us. In other words, Meet the Newmans is this show that is past its time. Mm-hmm. It's now starting to look very staid in the 1960s in the US. And I got the sense of we're exploring how it feels to be left behind. The knowledge that what you're doing is no longer, it feels out of date, but you're still doing it because it's earning you money. It's keeping you going. It's keeping a roof above your head. But the sense that you already know I am yesterday, and there's plenty of people in entertainment who will be able to relate to that. But I just wanted you to just explore that bit for us a little bit more. The idea that you can sense that you're being left behind.
Yes, and I think that is something that is very prevalent and weighs very heavily on the shoulders of all of these Newmans, and. You know, one thing they worry about is that this has been their life for so long. And while they may have issues with it, Dinah, you know, effectively is, when we first meet her, is going through her life kind of on autopilot. Mm. And the boys, Guy, the older son, is in love with his roommate, Kelly, who is an actor and a man, and he can't, you know, show any of that on television. And Shep, the younger one, is just rebelling because he wants to play the music he wants to play. He's in love with someone who, you know, he can't get. And so they all have something that they're struggling with. And Del, especially the father, can't imagine what his life would be if he wasn't doing this show. None of them know who they are off screen. And I think that's part of the problem of being left behind, or that fear of being left behind, is it's easier to keep doing this that they've been doing forever, because what do they do when it ends? Who are they individually as a family? And I think that's very, you know, scary for all of them.
Because it's being left behind, which any grown-up senses that, you know, they used to know all the new music that was around, all the new movies that were around and so on. And now you kind of go, okay, I don't really quite understand it. But what happens with the Newmans and what gives it the kind of edge and the backbone is the kind of politics with a small p that you tackle here. And there is a lot of reference to The Feminist Mystique by Betty Friedan, a book I have not read, but came out in 1963 and is very, very important. So that kind of thrust of what it's like to be a woman in 1964 is obviously where the book spends a lot of time. Can you introduce us to the kind of that kind of feminist side and the edge of this book?
Mm-hmm, definitely. I think for Dinah, who is, you know, of all of them, is probably the voice and the main character. I mean, the one that I follow most in the book. And for Dinah, who is, as I said, kind of an autopilot, kind of asleep when we first meet her, I needed her to wake up. and I need her to be challenged. And the way that she is she has an interview very early on in the book with this young, ambitious, impassioned reporter named Juliette Dunn, who works at the LA Times and is given this fluff piece to write and is indignant about it. Because Juliette feels like women like Dinah are the problem because they haven't done the things they need to do. Dinah represents, this is what women should do. They should be in the kitchen. They should be cleaning and up after their families and be there when their husband comes home from work. And she, by not showing any other, options, Juliette is just incensed by the time she meets Dinah. And I think I needed that clash. And Juliette introduces Dinah to the feminine mystique by Betty Friedan, which was that book was so huge, at least in the States in 1963 when it came out. Now, there are a lot of problems with the book. It excludes a large number of women in the population, women who didn't earn a lot of money, women who were single, women who were of color. But the thing it did do was revolutionize or at least plant the seed in a lot of minds of women in that era that there was more. There was more out there than just the things they'd been told that they should be doing. And it was alarming to me doing the research because I discovered all these things and I put those into Juliette's kind of impassioned, being that women couldn't get credit cards and on their own. They couldn't have bank accounts on their own. They couldn't buy contraception unless they were married and had their husband's permission.
These are all moments where I think the reader's jaw will drop to the floor. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, my jaw dropped while I was writing it, and I felt like Juliette, just like, what is happening? Like, how is that even possible? And that I wanted Dinah to see that, not only through Juliette's eyes, but I wanted her to wake up and see around her and realize that she's living in a world on screen that doesn't exist. So it probably never really existed in real life. And she needs to step out into the world that does exist and is very problematic. And women are fighting for rights. And I wanted her to be a part of that.
So that argument that, as you say, Dinah and Juliette have, that for me is, that's a...
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
A really key set piece that you have in the book, and that is the one that got me thinking the most, because as you're right, as Juliette is impassioned and saying, you are part of the problem here because you are not helping. The role that you're playing on TV is not helping. And Dinah is pushing back by saying, I am here to entertain. And it reminds me of that, the argument about whether you include, if you're entertaining, if you're putting on a sitcom or whatever, do you have a message in there? And it's a sort of the Seinfeld argument, which is, making people laugh is the hardest thing in the world, and I will not sacrifice one inch of telling people how to think in order to make people laugh. Making people laugh is all that counts. And there is a counter argument that says when you have that platform, you should use it. If you know there are things wrong and you know people are listening and they will take notice of what you have to say, you should use it. It is absolutely a duty of yours to use it. And those are two sort of contrasting sides of the argument that you have Juliette and Dinah talking. And I just wanted to ask you, because I often find myself on both sides of that. I can absolutely see both sides of that argument. And I'm intrigued to know what you think of those two sides.
I feel the same way. I feel like, I mean, I felt very much like Dinah, but also like Juliette. And I think that this is just kind of case in point, just an illustration of that. Yesterday, I wanted to post something on my Instagram because there's a lot of tumult and upset in the US right now. And I wanted to post something, but I don't want to be political necessarily on my feed, but I also don't want to be silent. So it was that kind of moment of how much do you put out there and what do you say while wanting to somehow put positivity back into the world. And so I think in that moment when Dinah and Juliet are, you know, having this conflict, I feel both sides. I felt Dinah's, you know, resistance to it because she is there to entertain. But as Juliet says, you do have a voice and you do need to use it, and probably more responsibly than you're, you know. But I also like this intergenerational dynamic and conversation between these women, because as Dinah points out to Juliet, my generation may not have knocked down the barricades or kicked down the doors in the way that you would like, but we did some of that. You can't look at us now through your eyes in 1964 and judge what we did or didn't do when we were your age. And I think that there's something very interesting in that as well.
You need Dell out of the way for a bit.
Oh, yes. He needed to go somewhere.
Yeah. And then a lot of the chapter headings are, you know, 48 hours before the accident. So we know that there's something bad that's coming. Why did he need to be removed from the situation altogether? I mean,
How are we going to negotiate this?
Okay. So what I'm saying, you needed Dell out of the way. You need the show to be in the hands of Dinah and of Juliet. So what did you know all along when you set off to tell this tale, the way you were going to park him?
I love that, parking him. Yeah. I did not know exactly how I was going to park Dell, but I knew I needed to, and I knew it needed to happen, you know, probably in the first act of the book.
Which is why I think it's okay to mention it, but yeah.
I think so too, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say, you know, Dell is, he's in an accident, and he is parked for a while because he cannot go back to work, and that leaves them absolutely no choice, but they, you know, Dinah, her sons, they have to take over for Dell, with Dinah really leading the way. And that's something she never thought she would do. As creative as she is, as a singer and an actress and a former dancer, she has never, you know, taken charge of their on-screen personas. And now she's faced with having to write the season finale and produce that. And I needed her to do that because that's part of how it's a big part of how Dinah awakens and also comes into her own finally.
So you are taking us in this book behind the scenes of this fictional TV show, where we learn very, very early on that although Dinah is on TV always making fabulous meals and cleaning the house and all of those things, we learn very early on she doesn't do any of that at home. And there's a point in the book where Dinah is remembering a conversation she has with her husband, Dell, where Dell has been offered a huge amount of money to write a book about what it is actually like for them, for the Newmans, at home, away from when they're in a TV studio, and he's turned it down. And she says, no, you should do it, because we all have a behind the scenes. We all have this, and people are always going to be interested in that, which is true, they are. But it sparked for me how people use social media now, and in particular celebrities using social media, and in particular using perhaps their family, drawing back the veil and saying, this is my life, obviously curating that for the best possible outcome. But people routinely use that behind the scenes now. And I wonder, I mean, we've had we're recording this in sort of late January, we had the whole Brooklyn Beckham thing happening last week, which illustrated what happens, how it can go wrong. Let's just talk a little bit about that, about this idea of the dangers of stripping back the veil and showing everyone the behind the scenes.
I think it's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because we all have a behind the scenes, and we all have things that maybe we don't want to show to maybe people in our own lives or the public or what have you. And I think that for me, it was important to show these people who have represented what they've represented to, whether it's just entertainment or this kind of idealized perfection that, never exist in real life. As we say, like, Dinah can't actually cook. She doesn't know how to cook. She's had a housekeeper for years. And even though she's America's favorite homemaker. And it was just so important to me to remove the curtain and show what was behind the scenes for all of them, not just for Dinah, but for the guy, for Shep, for Del, for Juliet, for any of the characters in the story. And I think one reason that's so important is because when I was traveling for All the Bright Places years ago, which is a young adult book I wrote 11 years ago, I met so many young readers who said to me over and over and over again, thank you for writing this book and letting me know it's okay to be messy, it's okay to be, you know, feel all these things, and it's okay to be human. And I just thought, oh my God, there are so many of us, all of us, who are struggling to some degree or another with what, you know, the real person, and then the, you know, what, as you say, what's curated, kind of the curated behind the scenes, which is different.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about song lyrics, because you have to write some song lyrics, and music is a very important part, because obviously 1964, there's a lot going on in America, and America is in love with British music, of course. Anyway, so just picking up on what you and Matt were just talking about in terms of image, there is a song which I was listening to this morning by T-Bone Burnett, and it's called Image. And these are all the words, okay? This is the whole song. I had this image of you, you had this image of me, and your image would talk to my image, and my image would talk to your image. And somewhere along the way, our images sort of let each other down.
Oh, God, I have a chill.
Well, that sounds like your book. That's what they're doing. All their images are talking. It takes a while for them to break it all down and for them to speak to each other as ordinary people rather than the images which they are portraying. Anyway, I recommend T-Bone Burnett. It's a fantastic song. But you have to... So Shep is a pop star.
Yes.
And Juliet, our LA Times journalist, has been hanging out with a bona fide rock star, who you call the musician, who is clearly English.
Yes.
I also know this because on the audiobook read by Marin Ireland, she does an English voice.
Really?
Yes. We don't hear a lot from him, but when we do, he's definitely in the kind of 60s British way. Who did you have in mind for that? Who were you thinking of? And did you enjoy writing the pop lyrics?
I imagined Juliet for me was kind of, I pictured a young Marianne Faithfull. Mm-hmm. And Marianne Faithfull, during the time I pictured her, was very publicly dating Mick Jagger. And so the musician is kind of a combination of Mick Jagger at that age and also Robert Plant, who supposedly was so lovely. You know, I don't know how he is. I've never met him. I'm sure he's lovely.
He is lovely, yeah.
But everything I've read, because I love Led Zeppelin, everything I've read about them, he seemed very like the musician as I wrote him. So he's a combination of those two. But I wanted to, I called him the musician. I was calling him that just as I was writing the book. And I thought I would go back and give him a name. But then in some books where they say, oh, that's so-and-so, he's the biggest star in the world, and his name is, I don't know, Jeremy Smith. And you think, well, that's not a real person, but you have to, like, suspend, of course, you know, belief. But I wanted to just call him the musician so that you could just kind of imagine.
Yeah, enigmatic.
Know. Yes. And in terms of writing the pop lyric, like the lyrics, that's something, oh my gosh, when I was 12 or so, I would just sit in my room and write lyrics because I thought I wanted to be a rock star and I wanted to be like the Go-Go's or the Bangles or Blondie, like groups I grew up on. And they were very bad lyrics, by the way, like terrible lyrics. I've gone back and read them. But I loved writing the song that the musician writes for Juliet. And then also some of Shep's. And I think part of that is, I mean, I have a musical background-ish, but I think it's just knowing your characters so well that you can kind of interpret what they would put down on paper, if that makes any sense.
Yep. So, as you say, this is a it's a fictional TV show you've made up, but it is set in the real world. So, as you say, you know, we have the musician. I think it's the Redlands episode that you almost completely you use within within the book itself, which obviously happened. There are two other things that I'd like to, or one other thing really that I'd like to ask you about that are real things that you reference in the book, and one of those is real TV episodes. So there is a I Love Lucy episode called Lucy is Enceinte, so French for pregnant, and the Dick Van Dyke Show, That's My Boy. So Dinah says those two shows made history. Now I think we can probably take a guess at what the first one is, but just to illustrate why those two shows in America changed history.
Well, for Lucy, no one had ever shown a pregnant woman on television at that point in the 1950s, when Lucy was very pregnant with their son, and Lucy behind the scenes. Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz fought to have that. Instead of hiding her behind furniture or pillows or what have you, they fought to show her on television. Like they said, no, I mean, Ricky and Lucy are married. We're married in real life. And, you know, the producers and the sponsors thought that would be so shocking for some reason to show.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's absolutely amazing.
I mean, this is they're married on the show and they're married in real life. And I don't see what the, you know, but it was a big deal back then. And then the Dick Van Dyke Show, which is one of my favorite shows, is so brilliantly written and acted. The Dick Van Dyke Show, That's My Boy episode had the longest laugh in television history at that point. So they laughed so much, I think they delayed the broadcast of the next show.
Wow.
The premise really is just Dick Van Dyke, who plays this TV, you know, writer, he believes that their son, Richie, was mixed up at the hospital and they got a different baby because of all these kinds of coincidences that happened. And so he's convinced that this other, you know, they're the Petries. He's Rob Petrie. Well, there's another family with a similar last name who was there the same day, also had a baby. So he's convinced they have each other's babies. And he decides to meet this family and, you know, discuss this. And he is so wound up about this in the way that only Dick Van Dyke can get. And the family comes in. He answers the door, and you don't see them yet, but you see Dick Van Dyke's face, and then they walk in, and they're black. And the laugh is like, and the wonderful thing about that episode was that the couple was in on the joke, the couple who comes in. So it changed history in the sense that he was the one who was acting foolish. And he was the one who was, the joke was on him. They were in on the joke as well. And they were this attractive, you know, well-dressed, clearly like upper middle class couple. So it was all in the subtleties, right? The depiction and the just arrangement of the story. And that was a huge deal, that moment. And it's hard to imagine now that was such a big moment on television, but it was. And those two episodes really were so revolutionary because they paved the way for now other shows that actually starred, you know, black actors and people could have babies and be shown in the same, maybe in not separate beds, you know, like Lucy and Ricky had to sleep in. So it's amazing those kinds of cutting, you know, that those things were so monumental.
I think you're right. I think it's wrong for us to scoff at what they were doing at that time. These were monumental decisions to make. I cannot imagine the conversations they will have had to have had with executives, the threats that will have been put against them for doing that, even though to our ears right now they seem so banal, so
Absolutely.
Easy to do, showing a woman who's pregnant. What is the problem with that? But back then, this was a huge deal. And I, as you say, momentous, that they, and as you say in the book, that they made history with those episodes.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It is. It's shocking. And it's, you know, it kind of goes back to what Juliet and Dinah were talking about, when Juliet can't imagine why Dinah would put up with the things that she puts up with. And the fact that Dinah doesn't even know the things that women can't serve on juries and women can't, you know, they can't get the credit cards or get contraception. Dinah's ignorant of all of that. And I think it kind of, you know, goes back to that, and that it is so, I think when I was writing this, I was so shocked by so many things that were happening. And yet I feel like it's also topical, in the sense that I feel like it's something that audiences today can relate to, because as I've had some readers say, it feels modern in a way that's probably, you know, we wish it didn't too, with especially with the what the women are going through.
So the book and the Newmans lead up to the season finale.
Yes.
Which I just had a couple of questions about it. Did you know, you don't need to tell us what happens, but when you started off, did you know what was going to happen in the season finale, or just that it was a good idea to finish the story there?
I didn't actually know, but I had an idea of, you know, I wanted something with her pearls. I wanted something with her shedding the pearls, what, you know, as symbolic as that is. So I knew that's what I wanted her to do, both literally, but also just figuratively. And I, you know, I had that sense going in, and it was really fun to write toward that. So to feel Dinah, you know, coming into her own and really standing up, and then really discovering as I wrote what Dinah would want to write and how she and Juliet would want to liberate both Dinah, but also the rest of the family.
Are they pearl earrings you're wearing?
They are.
Yes.
Thank you for noticing
there
that.
You go.
Also,
yes.
There you go. And you, in the acknowledgements at the end, you thank, Dinah and Juliet have a focus group of women.
Yes.
Who kind of provide an energy and a direction for that final episode. And it sounds like you had your own focus group, that you got a bunch of women in to what? Come up with opinions about what it was like to be a woman now? Or
yes, absolutely. I asked some of my dearest friends, some of whom are authors as well, but from all walks of life, I asked them what they felt about being a woman today and the challenges, the, you know, the loveliness of it, what they feel like, you know, they struggle with both personally, but also in society. And it was fascinating. It was so, I don't know, eye-opening and also just kind of affirming.
But how can that input into your 1964 conversation where things were so different?
Things were, because there's so many similar feelings. I feel like, you know, even though this is in 1964, I feel like when I talked to my friends in 2024 or 25, when I was writing the book, it felt like, you know, something Juliet and Dinah and all of the secondary characters that they talked to in the women's focus group, it felt like all the things that they were still struggling with in terms of identity, in terms of the apologies that we as women feel like we have to always be making. One of them says, you know, I'd love just like to be a, like, I'll censor the language, but be a jerk if I want to and not have to apologize for it. And I want to just be free to be myself. I want to be free not to be fearful when I walk, you know, in a parking lot at night. I want to not, you know, be afraid of what this man or this man that I work with is going to say to me. I mean, all of those things are so relatable no matter what decade you're in.
this has to be a TV show on Netflix. You've got contacts in Netflix. You've got contacts in television. This is probably already happening, yes?
There is interest. Nothing is, but the option's open. So I'll just put that out there. The option is still open.
Very surprised if people don't jump up and down.
Thank you.
On this. Finally, Jennifer, we'll do another podcast with you in a few days' time for the Q&A. You mentioned the Instagram that you were considering writing about the situation back at home. What did you write in the end?
In the end, I quoted from All the Bright Places, and I'll probably misquote it now, which will be embarrassing.
But it's, but it's your work, so...
It's my work. So, yes. So, actually quoted the movie, the last lines of the All the Bright Places movie, in which I say, you know, in the world, in this dark world, basically, you know, there are bright places. And if you can't find them, you can be that bright place. And that's what I put out there. And then it, the reaction was just so lovely. People saying that that's what they needed to hear. And they love to be reminded of that.
So a little bit of Diana, a little bit of Juliet in there.
Absolutely.
In there. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, it's been fantastic having you on. Thank you very much indeed. Jennifer Niven's book is Meet the Newmans. There'll be more with Jennifer in a few days' time when our Q&A episode hits. But for the moment, Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for this.